After being forbidden for the best part of a century, the plant known as cannabis is now open for business, but only in some places. This leads us to ask, can reefer madness be turned into a sustainable business?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1187th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, in 1936, a movie directed by Louis Gessner hit the silver screen entitled Reefer Madness. The story followed three drug dealers as they lured innocent teenagers into becoming addicted to reefer cigarettes with wild parties featuring jazz music. 1 year later, 1937, reefer was prohibited, and Reefer Madness became a cult movie classic that over the years led many innocent teenagers into lighting up reefer cigarettes. Funny how that worked. 8 decades later, we the people are working our way out of the blue haze of reefer smoke to legalize the plant that has been with us since the Garden of Eden. We now call it cannabis, which is the plant's botanical name. But for one reason or another, we have yet to rid the madness part of reefer madness. Take for one example the plant's legal status. Cannabis is a Class 1 narcotic in the United States of America and is therefore prohibited. But cannabis is legal in some of the nation's states. In some states, it is legal when used medicinally, but not recreationally. In other states, it is legal when used as a medicine and as a recreation. In other states, it is still prohibited. In some counties and cities where cannabis has been made legal, one may grow the plant indoors, but not outdoors. In other counties, one may grow indoors and outdoors. While in still other counties, one may not grow the plant at all. You get the idea. The business of cannabis is still ripe with madness and leads us to ask, can reefer madness be turned into a sustainable business? Well, who better to ask than Jim Coffus, who is the co-founder and deputy director of Green Trade Santa Cruz. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Today we are in Santa Cruz, California, and you have set up an organization called Green Trade Santa Cruz. What exactly is Green Trade Santa Cruz?
Right after the California voters passed Proposition 64 in November 2016, it became apparent that there would have to become a legal supply chain for cannabis. Santa Cruz at that time, and remains, is a fairly active community. It's always been very pro-cannabis, and we have a history and a legacy of not only cultivating, but selling and distributing and processing, formulating all kinds of cannabis products, and have been for many years.
Mm-hmm. So one day we woke up to the fact that what Santa Cruz County has been doing all along is now legal.
Exactly.
Wow, what do we do now?
Well, we watch as the government tries to an experiment of something of the kind of proportions that I've never seen in my lifetime, which is to take a billion-dollar illicit market and try to incorporated into the legal market.
Mm-hmm. And there's always something interesting about the way government does things, you know?
Well, with respect, nobody's ever done this, so.
Yeah, it's kind of a huge, huge mess when it gets right down to it. How did you become involved in the business of cannabis?
Well, strangely enough, I am a longtime consumer. Mm-hmm. And I have been intimate with cannabis in this area since the 60s. And So I've watched it as it's progressed. I voted early on in a measure that lost in California to legalize cannabis. Right. And then over the years, we became the first state to actually allow it for medicinal use, it was called. And then after I retired, I watched as the government locally tried to regulate the cultivation of cannabis, particularly in the Santa Cruz Mountains where I live. I had a lot of neighbors and friends that were involved, and as the process unfolded, I just became more fascinated, and I began to meet more and more people involved in all facets of the industry, and I just became fascinated with it.
Well, you've been around a long, long, long time, and so you probably remember the days when cannabis used to come from Mexico in solid bricks that had been compressed into dust almost.
To see how many you could fit in an airplane
or whatever.
Back of a Volkswagen. Right.
But the funny thing about that, those bricks of Mexican cannabis, is that they all came filled with seeds. And lo and behold, they shipped all of these seeds, and people looked at the seeds, and they looked at the price of, you know, that they were paying for that cannabis, and they were the thought just went straight into the ground with the seeds, and thus became pretty much a thriving industry in California. There are locations throughout California where the industry really took hold. One of them being the Emerald Triangle up in Northern California, Humboldt, Mendocino County area up there.
Another, Shasta.
Yeah. And another being the Santa Cruz Mountains that stretch down the peninsula from San Francisco all the way down into the Monterey Bay, which is where we are talking today. But what is it about this little city of Santa Cruz that made it particularly susceptible to falling in love with cannabis?
Well, I'm sure that the culture had a lot to do with it. But actually, the cultivation of cannabis in the Santa Cruz Mountains probably parallels the organic farm movement. People just started moving out to the farm, right? Mm-hmm. There was an exodus of hippies, they were called.
Right.
That took up, started homesteading and experimenting with communes and the different lifestyles.
Going up the country.
Going up the country. And so and organic farming actually has its roots.
The movement
has its roots in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Right, very much so. And as long as we're growing veggies.
Here's all these seeds.
And
so some of the best cannabis in the world is grown right here.
What about the trees? Do the trees have anything?
Some of the best trees in the world are grown right here, too.
And with those trees, you could hide what you're doing, too.
That was until Google Earth and airplanes came into
being. Yeah. But that was part of the early magic here as well.
Exactly. There were plenty of hidden spots where you could that were pretty inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And this was a problem because public lands were being used.
Sure.
Cartels were coming up where they'd just hire a couple guys to hang out with the plants for 6 months. And all kinds of havoc could occur.
Right. And so that made it pretty attractive. And then one other element of this neck of the woods that made it probably pretty susceptible to starting the farming of cannabis, and that would be the technology that's in the neighborhood. I think I speak especially of the Pajaro Valley and the Salinas Valley, some of the most technologically precise agriculture in America is right here. And I suspect, just having that, the proximity to that technology probably rubbed off a little bit on the cannabis growers too.
Vice versa as well, because the prohibition of cannabis led to, as you say, the growing under the trees, but it also spurned an indoor cultivation phenomena. And so there was a race on to develop the best systems to grow in enclosed circumstances. So the Dutch got into the game in a pretty big way. A lot of the technologies that are now common in traditional agriculture saw their roots in cannabis.
Right. And even more technologically precise than that is growing under lights. A long time ago, I had the assignment from the San Francisco Examiner to go up to New Seattle because word had spread that people were using lights to grow cannabis. Well, in Seattle, it's always raining, so you have to do something. So I went up there, and my hosts, first thing they did, they took me to a Seattle Supersonics game in the big cavernous sports arena. And all they did was ogle the lights. And I thought, this is really strange. And after that, they took me to this inconspicuous house out in the suburbs. And we went to this house, maybe 11, 12 o'clock at night, and opened the door, and the big, huge cloud of cannabis aroma just rolled out the front window. And down in the basement, they had a regular farm set up under lights. You know, and that technology also really has fed into the world of cannabis production, too.
Yes.
Lights, growing with lights. Yes. So let's step back a little bit. Why on earth did we make it illegal in the first place?
That's a political question that's pretty loaded. But step back before it was illegal.
No pun intended, right?
Yeah. Before it was illegal, in the 20s, it was the number one, cannabis was the number one ingredient in any kind of pharmacology that was sold in America. So all the ailments, instead of getting an aspirin, you got a bottle of this or that that had CBD or cannabis in it. And that was the remedy. It became a political issue and took on a life of its own when Prohibition came along. Destroyed the hemp industry as well.
Sure. Henry Ford was making cars out of hemp and fueling them with hemp as a demonstration of the wonderful capabilities. But who said we have to stop this?
Well, Henry Anslinger, I think, was the guy that was the force behind the Prohibition. But I'm sure there were a lot of people involved.
And Henry Anslinger was one of the principals of Prohibition.
He'd lost his job after Prohibition was abolished.
And so that had a lot to do with why he was interested in the... that's why he was interested in setting up Prohibition, because he lost his job. And he did a very good job of setting up Prohibition, did he not?
It sure did work. I mean, it destroyed the hemp industry effectively. And, as far as this creating a stigma around the use of cannabis,
reefer
that
madness
goes without saying.
Yeah. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about the cannabis industry that is emerging from 8 decades of prohibition. And how can we get rid of all of the madness that still persists? Right back. Stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What today is the cannabis industry and our dilemma and how to set it up so that it works for everybody. Right now, it's just emerging from 8 decades of prohibition, and the rules and regulations and taxes and everything are so scattered and crazy that people are having trouble figuring out what exactly to do and how to do it. Let's tackle exactly what is the status of cannabis right now. It's illegal in the United States of America, right?
Yeah. It's very complicated. Let's just say that. There are bills in Congress right as we speak that are moving it toward federalization. And most smart money says 2 to 3 years at the maximum before it becomes legal nationwide and then internationally.
Okay, so now 2 to 3 years, who's going to make it legal? I mean, do we have politicians who are going to step up to the plate?
Well, like I say, there are bills moving their way through Congress as we speak. Mm-hmm. There's not many politicians that have been willing to kind of stand out in front on this issue because, frankly, there are a lot more issues in this country that are more compelling than cannabis at the moment. But there are and have been certain politicians that have, you know, tried to advance it, and more and more by the day. I mean, the presidential candidates on the Democratic side have to speak whether they're for or against this.
Right, so and, that's the fun thing about an election.
Yes.
Where do you stand? Take the stand so we know where you stand. Yeah. Absolutely. And
a lot of Republican politicians, I mean, Mitch McConnell led the way for the legalization of hemp.
And the Farm Bill, yeah, absolutely, mm-hmm. which was a huge step forward with respect to the industry. Now, I guess we may as well figure out what the difference is between hemp and cannabis. Or is there a difference?
Well, it's like saying what's the difference between an heirloom tomato and a, you know, some other brand name.
Okay. So if you look at the Latin binomial for hemp, it's cannabis sativa, which is just one of the...
Cannabis rudaceae, I think.
It was cannabis sativa, I think. That's what I saw this morning, at any rate, for hemp. And all it means is that that's one strain. There's also cannabis indica, which comes from the Muslim territories of the world. And cannabis, what was the other one?
Rudaceae,
yeah. So there's three essential strains of cannabis, one of which has the long, slender stalks that are ideal for the hemp fiber, and that would be the sativa, as I understand it. But it's not different than the rest of the cannabis. It's just different because it was selected for one thing over the other thing.
Well, there's, yes, and I mean, those are the three main strains that have been identified to date. Mm-hmm. And there, I've seen plants that don't look anything like each other that produce the same CBD and THC and terpenes and so forth.
So I guess when you set up a situation where you legalize hemp, you're legalizing one kind of cannabis over the other kind of cannabis then?
For the moment,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, in California, it's actually legal to, you can get a license to grow cannabis, but not yet can you have permission to grow hemp, but it's coming very quickly.
More of that madness, right? Yeah. More of that madness, okay. Let's talk a little bit about how, going back to the United States legalizes it, then what? Well, because haven't we signed a single convention treaty in which we agreed with all but, what, two or three countries in the world that we would not be doing this?
And that has been debated in the United Nations. There are a number of nations that have gone forward and legalized. Canada has legalized. Mexico has legalized. Thailand. There's some Eastern European countries that have legalized. Mm-hmm. So that convention will ultimately fall by the wayside as well.
So doesn't it have to be repealed?
It would, essentially, yes. Yeah.
So would not every country actually have to step up and say, I officially repeal this treaty? I mean, I don't know how that works.
I don't know exactly how that works either, but once you have a sufficient number of trading partners, it becomes moot. And the,
it's kind of like the way that laws are dissolving in front of us here in the United States, then. They're just kind of dissolving away because people are just saying, we're going to do this anyway.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other
Yeah. Well, very interesting. You know, again, it's part of the reefer, the madness of the cannabis industry right now, which everybody's trying to figure out. So we legalize it here in the United States. We overturn the treaty that we have with all the other nations. And then we do what the states have already been doing, which is legalizing it. Now, there's different kinds of legalizations for each state, isn't there?
Well, for each county in California, there's different kinds. I mean, it's, you know, ultimately, Michael, this is agriculture, and that will prevail. And we're going to have to go through some years of figuring it out and playing the the. You know,
well, that's what we're talking about. That's the fun part, right? Well, we're right in the middle of the madness.
I don't know. I don't know how many people think this has been fun. Maybe the, there's probably a group of lawyers who are enjoying it. But
for storytellers, it's kind of interesting.
Very fascinating. You know, most fascinating. I mean, it's unlike anything this society has been through.
Because here's a plant that has been with us since the
10,000 years.
Forever. Forever we've been using this plant for one thing or another thing or for a whole bunch of things. And all of a sudden we step up and say, this reefer is madness. We're going to prohibit it and you can't have it and you can't use it. And then they put out all of this wonderful propaganda that convinces us that we simply must try it. If it's that bad, it must be good. Yeah. We have to try this.
Well, there is an explosion in the CBD market right now, and that's being driven by simply the fact that this conversation has been elevated to mainstream. It's no longer, you don't have to whisper about it.
Right. And that was the case for many, many, many years, 80 years. You had to really whisper about it or go to jail, one of the two. Mm-hmm. Now that it's kind of legal, we're trying to come to grips with how we go about doing this. How does the legal business work?
Well, it's you have a whole supply chain that's being regulated, so it has to work in combination with the other parts of the supply chain. So the retailers have to only work with tested product that comes from licensed distributors.
Well, let's start with the farming of it itself, agriculture.
Yeah, the producer. Okay, and that is a very interesting piece because what we did in California was we allowed anybody to grow their own cannabis.
Okay.
So
it's legal for Jim and Michael to go out and grow our own pot?
I grew my first legal plant last season.
Was it as fun as the illegal ones?
It is more fun. It is the most fun. It's in fact, it's a very simple plant to grow.
Yeah.
Very beautiful plant. It's fun. I grew one next to my tomato plants in Ben Lomond under the redwood trees. And it grew to be 8.5-9 feet tall.
Wow.
And bushy. Beautiful.
And it was yours.
It was all mine.
It was all yours. And having been a consumer of cannabis for ever and ever and ever, you had your first legal cannabis, all that you did, grew yourself.
It was like, it's like slicing a tomato out of your garden onto your salad, yes. Uh-huh.
Wow. And of course, you're up there in the mountains where pretty near everybody grows their own.
Well, a lot of people do, yes. Yeah. Not sure. And a lot of people grow for other people. That's the great thing about it, is it's a community. It breeds community.
Sure.
And
kind of like zucchini.
Exactly.
You need some zucchini. I have some extra zucchini. Yeah. Here it is. So we have the farmers. It's legal. It's legal in some places to grow it, not in the others. How does that work for interstate commerce?
Well, so far, no interstate commerce, although the state of Oregon just passed and signed into law their ability to sell. They said, our producers can sell to other states if the other states allow it. so far. They're the only state.
Isn't that in direct contravention to the interstate commerce controlled by the federal government, in which it's still illegal then?
That would be needed to be determined by law.
Yeah. You love those Oregonians here. We're going to do it anyway.
And they haven't yet found another state to reciprocate with.
There you go. Well, the problem with Oregon is that when they legalized it, they grew so much of it, they didn't know what to do with it all.
Well, they're selling it. Trust me.
Okay.
There's a market.
Okay. Good to go. So there's different states have different ways of doing things, and different regions have different ways of doing things. I think of the Emerald Triangle, up in Humboldt, Mendocino,
Trinity
counties, where it became very famous for cannabis production. And not only that, the cannabis sustained those three counties. That was
big part of the economy.
That was the economy.
Big part of the economy.
No logging left, no fish to catch, cannabis to grow. Now, what the heck is going on up there with all of those farmers having to compete with farmers down here in big, huge greenhouses or open fields?
Yes, the market, one thing that legalization did was disrupt the market completely. There was a functioning small-scale producer market. And, there were obviously larger-scale producers, but nothing to the...
You couldn't get too big because...
Yeah, you couldn't be spotted,
yeah,
right?
And exactly.
It's had a big effect on the small grower. Mm-hmm. Just like any small farmer, unless you're able to sell direct to the consumer, it's kind of difficult
to
sustain
it. You're in tough territory then.
And monocrop is really tough on a small scale. So
yeah. So up there, I recently saw a series of mini documentaries called Murder Mountain.
I have avoided watching that, but I know the story. Yes.
Yeah, very, very sad story about what happened to that area with legalization and how tough it's become for those folks up there to actually make money growing pot. It's a whole different world. Let's go here to the Monterey Bay Area, at Santa Cruz County. As I said earlier, this is one magnificent agricultural region. Though Santa Cruz County is one of California's smallest counties, dollar per acre, very few places in the world are more productive than this little tiny Santa Cruz County in the Pajaro Valley. And of course, we're right next to Monterey County in the great Salinas Valley, the salad bowl of the world. So this is agriculture at its best right here. How is our farming here in Santa Cruz County of cannabis working out?
Well, ironically, the largest area in Santa Cruz County that is zoned for agriculture, that is used for large-scale agriculture, is primarily in these days in berries, right? And we produce some of the best berries in the
big
world.
Big, plump, juicy, sweet berries. That's what we do, yeah.
And, but there used to also be a thriving cut flower industry here that has lost to competition from South America.
Well, didn't the federal government encourage the South African or South American farmers to stop growing flowers here and grow them in South America, so the farmers down there would stop growing cannabis
or cocoa
or yeah. coca. Yeah. Yeah. So this is one of the great ironies.
It is
just this irony is magnificent in scope. So we chased away our cut flower industry and gave it to South America, so the South American farmers would stop growing dope, and now
they grow carnations.
And they grow carnations.
No. And many other cut flowers. And that industry took a hit.
And we had empty greenhouses for years and years and years.
Still.
And
many of those are being converted now.
And they're becoming high-tech cannabis farms. Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it...
But it's not as easy as just changing a crop. That's...
No. Of course not. Now, how does one go about growing cannabis here in Santa Cruz County, in our little county? Because I understand a lot of the cannabis farmers have left this county for Monterey County. Why is that?
Well, Monterey County was a little quicker in setting up a ordinance that permitted the use of greenhouses for cannabis. And Santa Cruz County didn't get there quite as quick. And so the uncertainty drove people into Monterey and filled up a lot of that available greenhouse space.
Oh, now, do I detect a little free enterprise competition between counties?
Well, it certainly turned out that way. I mean, Monterey County reaped about $7 million in taxes in the first year as a result of that.
And Santa Cruz County?
Santa Cruz County, from the production side, has yet to raise a million. They've raised a couple of million in retail tax.
And that's why we see in the papers that the supervisors of Santa Cruz County are coming to grips with the fact that what they did set up did not work. And so then now they're coming to, well, we have to revise this to make it work again. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. I have Jim Koffis with us today. He is the co-founder and co-director, deputy director of Green Trade Santa Cruz. Brought a bunch of the industry together and is trying to figure out how the heck to make it all work.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back with Jim Koffis. He's the co-founder and deputy director of Green Trade Santa Cruz County. So a couple hundred thousand people in this little tiny county along the California Central Coast, one of the smallest counties in California. How many cannabis businesses are there here in this little town county?
It's a moving target that changes by the day, literally. But right now we have about 40 businesses that have a license of one sort or another.
Okay, these are the licensed businesses.
Yes.
What about the other businesses that don't have any licenses?
Well, prior to licensure, it was hard to get a real accurate number, depending on who you talk to. If you talk to the sheriff, there were thousands of growers. If you talk to the county government, there were, there were 700 people that came forward, said they wanted to get a license.
Which meant they were probably...
probably doing, and yeah. I mean, part of the eligibility was that you had to say that you had been growing cannabis for at least 2 or 3 years.
So you have to admit to committing a felony before you can become legal then.
Exactly. So 700 people did that, paid application, non-refundable application fee, and there was some pushback because they people did not want to self-identify as a criminal, so they allowed them to do it anonymously. But then they changed that and said, well, you have to at least identify the parcel number where you are growing or intending to grow.
Oh, goodness.
That whittled the list down to about 400. And I think that the that registration list today is somewhere in the 300 range. So
this is setting up a very interesting scenario where you have two classes of cannabis growers in one tiny little county. You have those that with licenses and the ability to be up front and grow cannabis, And you have those that say, heck with you. I'm just going to go ahead and go cannabis and follow my own rules, make my own rules here. Now, this sets up a very interesting scenario as it's almost like the prohibition of alcohol, where the government becomes the market leader or the market price setter. Am I wrong?
Well, they create the market.
They create the market.
They create their own market. And so what we have is two markets, like you say. We have a legal market, and then we have everything else. And some estimates put the everything else at about 75% of the total value of the market.
Okay, so most people are just saying, the heck with it, we're just going to continue doing what we've always done and see what happens.
Well, whether it's most people or most volume.
Most volume, okay. And again, it would seem like it would be hard to have a huge amount of volume if you're illegal, because then everybody knows you're illegal. I mean, if you, let's say you're...
Yes and no. I mean, you can have a large amount of... And some of it be legal and some of it be illegal.
Oh, even more crazy then. But I'm thinking of a situation, a scenario in which you're up there in a valley, and the beautiful green valley, and on one side of the valley you have a legal farm, and on the other side you have an illegal farm. And the legal farm, it notices a significant price drop in the value of their crop by virtue of the fact that the farm on the other side of the valley is growing a lot of pot without any restrictions or taxes or anything. Now, if I'm the legal farmer, I'm thinking about calling my friendly government and having them come out and put the other guy out of business. Does that work?
Well, I mean, we tried to eradicate cultivation of cannabis for most of my adult life.
Yeah, amen.
And I didn't see any significant change in the amount of production. If anything, it goes up. So I don't...
The more you repress the production, the higher the cost is, and thus you end up with cannabis that's worth $5,000 a pound or whatever. The better you become at prohibiting it, the more value it becomes.
Yeah, but we took away one huge tool, and that is that you can no longer be thrown in jail for growing cannabis. And that's a big deal. That takes a lot of the risk away. Now, of course, there's all kinds of financial penalties that you'll suffer. And in certain jurisdictions, the sheriff's departments still feel compelled to go and cut down the plants and seize property.
Well, they're kind
so
of
forth.
Like the revenuers now, aren't they? They're the ones that are controlling the supply.
Well, I don't know if they're being able to control the supply very much, but they are disrupting things.
Okay.
They can disrupt
okay.
it. They've never been able to really control the supply.
Yeah. Well, let's go from the producers, which are the farmers, to How do they sell it to people who...
Well, see, they sell it either as raw flower or trim, or they can, process it in any number of different ways. A lot of cannabis, particularly in Oregon, the cannabis is distilled rapidly into some kind of
concentrate.
Of concentrate of some mm-hmm. sort. And then, the processing is all kinds of processing into every kind of ingestible, from oils to cookies.
Okay,
right?
So they're the processors. Do they need a license?
Yes.
They need a license.
So you need a license to be a cultivator,
mm-hmm.
and you need a license to transport. Then you need a license to distribute. You need a license to test. And you need a license to sell.
Lot of licenses, and they're probably pretty expensive, aren't they?
They can run, to a big retailer, they can run in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But you could get in for $1,000 in some, this probably the smallest license.
In a very, very small town with four people in it, probably wouldn't cost much, right?
And that's just the state license. There's also local fees, and there's the hidden license and taxes are all the compliance costs, security, any number of things that a normal business wouldn't consider. Wow.
So let's say we're going to open up a pot shop here. In Santa Cruz County and compete with all the other pot shops that are already open. So we're going to have to buy a state license.
You need a state license, yes.
So, okay. And then we need a county license?
We need a county license or a city if you're in
city or
Santa
county.
Cruz. Okay. Or Capitola is just licensed. It's good, getting ready to give out two licenses.
Okay, so... handing out licenses, and so then we have two sets of licenses, and then we have to comply with rules and regulations.
Many.
Who sets up all those rules and regulations?
Well, the Proposition 64 prescribed a certain that the state would establish rules and regulations. They created a Bureau of Cannabis Control. That bureau gave authority to the California Department of Food and Agriculture, as well as the California Department of Public Health. And each of those, so public health controls manufacturing, agriculture controls producers, cultivation. The Bureau of Cannabis Control controls all the rest, distributors, transporters, retailers, and so forth.
Wow. So we have to mind our P's and Q's, otherwise we're going to be in big trouble really fast.
Well, it's all happening really fast. And so there's been some people who have lost their licenses already. There's been a couple of laboratories that have been lost their licenses. There have been people who have had their licenses revoked, so it's happening fast. Not as fast as most people would like. There's only been, for instance, about 500 or 600 retail licenses issued in the whole state of California, which creates a huge bottleneck for consumers.
Well, and it makes it very valuable to have one of those licenses, I suspect.
That's location, location, location.
Okay, so if you have a license, people come flooding to your door. Now, is there any indication of how much market share the legal people get as opposed to the legal illegal? I'm thinking retail, the actual consumers.
Well, it's hard to pin down numbers on those because
because it's like you folks up in the mountains, you know, everybody grows a little bit and gives it to their friends. And
there's that. There's also how big is the market, and how fast is the market growing? The explosion we're seeing of CBD products in health food stores and gas stations and everywhere else suggests that there is a much bigger in the market than most people imagine.
Is it effective, CBD? I mean, do we know? I know it's a great fad right now. Everybody's, you know, CBD works so well and blah, 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 blah. But do we really know?
Well, that's the saddest part about this whole prohibition is that we've lost 80 years of scientific research.
Yeah.
And I will tell from my own personal experience that, yes, it works. It's very effective. And the fact of the matter is it is... we live in an area where there has been a lot of research and study, and so we do have a lot of anecdotal data that is being compiled from Stanford University to throughout this region that will become more and more public. And as we now are able to do clinical trials, we're going to see a lot of progress in this respect.
I recently read of a study conducted by Radboud University in which they examined the history of 180,000 cannabis users and looking for, you know, side effects. What happened to you when you smoked it? The biggest single correlation side effect that they identified was schizophrenia. And I thought, wow. But do we do need some real research, don't we? I mean,
well, there has been some research. We, like I say, we could have had a lot more. I mean, we could. What all of the anecdotal research that we have could be more scientifically respected. Let's say that. But there's been research that's come out of Israel, a lot of research out of Europe. And more that's coming out of the United States that shows the efficacy of various strains on various conditions. And then as far as the, you know, the universal reaction to different effects of cannabis, you know, they're going to be as common as, you know.
Anything else, I suspect. Yeah. Well, it's a tough question now. Is there a way to take the madness out of the cannabis industry? Or is there something so intrinsically mad about the plant that will never get it out?
Well, that's not a hard question at all, because the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, the plant actually drives its, it is an enhancement to just about everything. I'm pretty prejudiced here, having grown up in California and watched what's happened in our culture. It's been my experience that cannabis has had a positive effect, not only societally, but medically and psychologically.
And it's become such a significant part of the culture and of people treating themselves for this and that too.
Yeah, there's it was, you know, I mean, the fact that you can do it yourself, you can grow this plant yourself, you can.
Which is what
it.
Your experience was, wasn't
yeah.
it? So it's growing it yourself in your backyard. It's your plant. You did this. Do you think that has something to do with why cannabis was made illegal in the first place?
No, I think it was more, I mean, probably somewhat to the extent that it was so easy to grow and it was could be so prolific.
There you go. We're out of time, Jim. But doggone it, I think I could talk with you for like forever. Jim Coffus, Santa Cruz Green Trade. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't.